Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by David Marks, who is the author of Blank Space, A Cultural History of the 21st Century. David, thanks for joining us from Japan. This is, I think, my first other side of the world conversation with somebody. So hopefully all the wires and tubes hold up.
I hope it works. I'm incredibly jet lagged anyway. So this is 7:30 is nothing.
Okay, good. So I'm really excited to talk about this book because both this and your previous effort, Status and Culture, are I think two extremely key ways to understanding our moment. But I'm also a little bit nervous because I had a hard time wrapping my arms around how to discuss this book with you, and I realized it's because you have put in book form the entirety of my adult life. The book covers basically the cultural history of 9/11 on, more or less, mm-hmm. if we want to use a cutoff point here. I'm a little bit before that, but and so much has changed. So much has changed, much of it for the worse, as I was, again, reading this book and kind of remembering all of the mm-hmm. things that happened. I was like, oh, I remember that. That was silly. Oh, that was silly and bad. Oh, this was evil. And it was a real trip down memory lane, and not necessarily the fun way. But again, the book is great. I really recommend everybody read it. I want to start where you start in the book. You start with the band Pearl Jam, which is mm-hmm. obviously before this era, strictly speaking. You start with the band Pearl Jam. And one of the things that you write about in your book is, you know, they held to the Gen X ideal of no selling out, right? We're not in this to make money. They went to war with Ticketmaster. They Yep. did not do music videos. They were not in it for fame. And what I thought to myself as I was reading it was, I remember all this. I also remember how much easier it was then to be a successful artist in that time period, at least in the sense of there was a way to make money. That way was selling CDs. They sold lots and lots of CDs. They didn't want to be mm-hmm. superstars, but they were anyway. Yeah. And that simply cannot happen anymore, right? Right. That feels like the big change to me over the last 25, 35 years. Once upon a time, you could sell a thing and be a big star. Now you have to sell yourself. That's how I would kind of summarize the shift. Is that about right?
I think that's right. I mean, so what I am getting at with Pearl Jam, I'm not even the biggest Pearl Jam fan. I just, in reading Chuck Klosterman's The 90s, was reminded that Pearl Jam became the biggest band in the world in about 6 months in 1992. And their decision based on that was, we're never going to make a music video ever again, which they kind of held for 10 years. And it's one thing to say, we don't want to be famous, but then you get famous and you kind of go along with it. But they actually did this pretty disruptive thing, and they were never punished by the fans. If anything, their next two albums did equally well and were breaking records for number of records sold in a week. And there's a value system that's there. And so they are not just in this kind of structural economic and technological system, but they have some values that they're exercising. And I mean, the market didn't necessarily want them to go the direction they did, but they stood up to the market. And I guess you're right that we're now in a world where you have to sell yourself and all these things, but the values went with that as well. So the technological and economic structure changed, and the value system also changed. And I think a lot of the analysis of this period has been, well, of course, it's the market's fault. But there's also just a thing that human beings can do, which is to stand up and not follow what the structure wants it to do, what the structure wants us to do. And that's gone away. And our values, I would say even more quickly than the market pushed us, the values went towards the things that Pearl Jam was fighting against. And that's why I really focus on this idea of poptimism, of really embracing pop music and manufactured pop as equally important as more alternative or indie kind of musics, because that was a value shift that happened. I think it's really hard to argue that that was the internet's fault, or that was, you know, the market had changed so much that you had to change these values. And so for me, what I'm really writing about in these 25 years is the value shift. And of course, the values come out of the shift in the structure. But at the same time, we've so absorbed the values that it doesn't even seem to be a resistance movement. And the thing about culture is resistance is always possible because culture can always be created for free. And it can always be created in small communities away from the market itself.
Let's talk about Poptimism, because I do think that this is, I 100%, this is one of the things that, again, has kind of leapt out to me about your last two books, is you really kind of break down what has happened here with Poptimism. But let's just explain to folks who may not be in the trenches of the critical culture wars, what is Poptimism? How did it come about? What does it represent?
So let me start with what it started with, and then we'll kind of look at where it went. So in the early 2000s, there was a debate within the top music critics. And people had gone to very good universities and were working at the Village Voice and New York Times and all these places. And it was more or less that there was a belief that music criticism had gotten too over-indexed on what was more or less white indie rock as being the only kind of music that warranted critical attention. So Radiohead's Kid A, everyone's freaking out that this is the greatest album ever. And there's a sense that, well, if you look at what Timbaland's doing with Missy Elliott, there's a lot of innovation there as well. And so to say that hip hop and R&B and these other genres, or what Mariah Carey is doing, is not as valuable is really, number one, it's sexist and it's racist, but it's also just leaving off the table all this incredible music that's not getting great reviews. And so there's this kind of schism between rockism and Poptimism that happens in the early 2000s. And the idea at the time, to really make the Poptimist argument in good faith, is that all we want is pop music. And even if it's manufactured and even if it's made for money, something like the Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears, it can be as good and it can be even more important and transgressive than rock music. And so all we're trying to do is equalize these two genres and make sure that pop music gets represented. Over time, something else happens, and I call it ultra-poptimism, and some people, the critic Carl Wilson just did this big essay on Poptimism, and he basically says this is an illegitimate form of Poptimism, but more or less it became, well, if pop music is as important, isn't it actually more important because it's more popular, that more people take joy from this music, that it is, tends to be music that is more representative of marginalized communities, so therefore we need to take it more seriously. And that, you know, popularity itself becomes a vector of which we can say this is more legitimate because it's more popular. So those ideas kind of swept in from various places. And so now we get to a point where Poptimism kind of, I think it's too simple to say it equates popularity with value, but we have this complete reversal of the 20th century avant-garde idea, which was that great art can't be understood by the masses. That in some ways that a vanguard is ahead of everyone else's tastes and does these things that are alienating. And so that kind of went away, where we now believe Taylor Swift is a genius, and she's not just a genius because, you know, obviously she's a business genius, but she's also a genius of poetry because she writes songs that people and her fans want to hear. So instead of the genius artist being ahead of the audience, the genius in this kind of Poptimist mold is somebody who can appeal to the needs of the audience. And that is a massive shift, I think, in the 20th century. So there's a lot of quibble about this word Poptimism, and a lot of these critics, I call them kind of anti-Poptimists because they don't claim to be Poptimists, but they really hate people picking on Poptimism. But there's some shift that you can label Poptimism that more or less just believes that pop music is the center of pop culture, from a critical perspective. And that's very different from the 20th century, where pop culture was always this thing that you maybe had to pay attention to once in a while, but the real innovation and the real meat of culture was happening on the margins.
And then, so what does the rise of Poptimism actually do to both the idea of criticism, but also what gets produced? Because I feel like we have seen a real shift, not just in how things are discussed, but frankly, what is made and what is celebrated. We've always had, there's always been pop music. There's always been popular artists. There's always been artists who are more popular than their critical reputation. But it does feel the demand for fealty to your Beyoncé's and your Taylor Swift's feels different now than anything that we would have experienced even back as far back as, you know, the Beatles and the Stones, which they had their own detractors and people came around, yeah. Whatever. I feel like things are different now. And your book does a really good job of breaking down how they are different. But for folks who haven't read it yet, what is the big difference?
I mean, one of the big differences is that if you live in a world of omnivore tastes, which means that in poptimism is kind of an extension of this idea that really starts in the 90s, where there's no low culture and there's no high culture. And the idea of putting cultural products on a hierarchy is elitist. If you live in a world where you're consuming everything, there's no longer really a taste or a content reason to disqualify anything that's come before. So Beyoncé has her moment, and then new artists pop up, and it's very difficult for them to say Beyoncé's old news. The kind of music she makes is lame and old, and we need to bury it, and we need to have this new sound, and we need to move forward. And so what happens is there's no mechanism within the culture itself to really get rid of artists who have become popular but have become stale and repetitive. In the case of Beyoncé, I think she's really helped herself by always using her platform to look for innovative kind of new beats and sounds and things to do. So she has her own kind of mechanism for this. But most of the 20th century, why we can tell the story of there's rock and then psychedelic rock and then roots rock and then prog and then punk and hip hop is because this every movement was a group of people who said the thing that is popular is terrible and we have to replace it with something else. And they really, you know, generated a lot of energy from that. And I think what's happening now is just if you have a Taylor Swift, and obviously she's really popular. She makes music that is designed to be popular, that is designed to be immediately understood. The top critics are going out of their way to find justifications for why it's good, and to show people that it's good. They're not a countervailing force against it. Other artists are not a countervailing force against it. And then you basically have no mechanism to remove the top artists from this world. I mean, I'm talking about music, but I think it extends to everything. It's just that popularity and marketing, especially in a world where attention is so hard to create, they have natural advantages of just seeming more central to the culture. And then there's no countervailing force at all within the artistic communities or within the critical community to really remove these people. So it feels stagnant because the reason we didn't have stagnation is because there was forces in the system trying to refresh the system. And that's kind of gone away. And so, I mean, there's lots of factors and they go through the book, but ultimately it comes from a place of people do not believe the thing that they're doing is going to replace the thing before. And they're not motivated necessarily by that need to invent something that's never happened before and to devalue the things that came before. And the end product is just that the market really doesn't have anything fighting it for control of everybody's attention.
Yeah. I'll just read from your book. This is how you put it in the book. Where society once encouraged and provided an abundance of cultural invention, there was now a blank space. Over the past 25 years, culture has prospered as a vehicle for entertainment, politics, and profiteering, but at the expense of pure artistic innovation. End quote there. And the lack of innovation is what you're talking about. And as you say, this extends beyond the realms of music and fashion, which your book is largely focused on here. Yeah. But this extends to movies, say, right? Like, who are the biggest movie stars in the world? It's Tom Cruise, it's Denzel Washington, Keanu Reeves, right? Like, these are guys who have been in our lives for decades now. I think this is one of the reasons why everyone is so excited about Timothée Chalamet, right? Is it, yeah. It feels like here's a new here's a new person. This is the new star. We can get behind this guy. And that the lack of innovation. All right. So let's say this posits like a secondary question, right? Which is that, is innovation good or necessary, right? Or have we kind of, there's an argument to be made that we have reached a terminal point in some of these art forms, like movies, yep. or even pop music to a certain extent, that, you know, the innovation is now happening elsewhere in the world of social media or short form video. How do you respond to that argument?
Yeah. And look, in a lot of human history, there's been incredibly conservative ideas about artistic excellence, that there's a best way to do things and everybody should follow that pattern. Or, you know, I mean, I live in Japan, and traditional Japanese arts and martial arts are all about, there's a perfect way of doing things. You learn from your, the teacher how to do it. And then over 20 or 30 years, you make these small incremental innovations. And then at the end of your career, maybe you've created some sense of innovation. So there's something very 20th century and avant-garde about this idea that innovation in itself is a good. But I think we have enough to look back in the last 100 years and say that every single time an artistic movement has come up with these new values and these new ways of seeing the world, they enrich the value of the world in the sense that we can look out at the world through all these different lenses. And so when you go from art having to be historical representation or mythical representation to, okay, art can now represent the world in front of us, that art can be try to represent three dimensions, not two, on a canvas. It can represent time. It can be surrealist. You know, all of these things made us be able to value the world in different ways. But they also open us up to understand how culture works, because we understand that there's not one perspective to see the world. There's not one way we can enjoy music. There's not one way we can see films. So it has been really important for human consciousness. I mean, this, it gets pretentious really fast to talk about this way, but every innovation adds to what a human mind can do and how we can see the world. And so when you get to this kind of stagnation, there's obviously political and economic consequences to it, but it's also just a really cynical belief that art doesn't do anything other than give us temporary pleasure. So if you simply think art is just a distraction, that then, and there's no difference between art and entertainment at all, then obviously then you're like, who cares about innovation? As long as every single day I wake up and I look at X and I look at Instagram and I'm entertained for the 3 hours I need it to entertain me, then yeah, there doesn't need to be any kind of invention whatsoever. But if you believe that there is this role that art can play in helping humans understand the world and each other and ourselves, then obviously we need this invention because it's constantly pushing our minds forward and letting us understand things in a broader way that has, I think, long-term positive consequences. So I see creative invention as a social good. And one of the things I'm just trying to do with this book is to say more or less that can we please understand that creative invention is a social good, instead of just thinking that we're fine in a cultural system that has invention and we're fine with one that doesn't have any invention as long as we're entertained.
Yeah. I mean, and these two ideas are very obviously meshed, poptimism and pure entertainment as the highest value. Like this is, these are two very similar ideas. And this also comes from, the introduction of your book, but I think it's really important here. And I just want to read this as well. With creators no longer required to pursue artistic excellence, culture becomes a lowest common denominator battle for attention. Where there is no value other than money, honor is meaningless. And where there is no honor, there cannot be shame. And without shame, infamy and esteem become indistinguishable. End quote. And I do think that that is the defining ethos of the internet age. I mean, you look at it, the rise of the influencer to the role social media plays in both politics and culture and everything else, which leads me, I think, to my next question here, which is, what role has the internet writ large played in this kind of flattening, all-encompassing statistics, stream numbers, et cetera, view of the world? Like, how has the internet kind of crushed all of this down into this lowest common denominator?
Yeah. And so with status and culture at the very end, I look at what are the system effects of the internet. And one of them that's huge is just the internet makes everything knowable and everything available. And knowledge and distribution of goods and the difficulty of acquiring goods was a huge way to imbue things with value before that we didn't necessarily notice. And so the internet has devalued everything. It's made signaling much more reliant on money. Then you have all the quantification that you just talked about, which is that every video you see now has a view count on it in a way that was not our experience before the internet. You know, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, and then there's the issues of disinformation and misinformation being able to use the same channels as, you know, we were promised an internet that would spread good information to all these oppressed populations and they would overthrow their dictators, but you know, the dictators can use the same tools for the same reasons. So it's so encompassing, it's hard to answer very quickly. The one thing I'd noticed writing this book I had never thought about before is, and I call this digital norm evasion, which is that I think the internet makes it impossible to have social norms and to enforce social norms. Because if you think about the clearest example is hardcore pornography, which is that it used to be that in a city, hardcore pornography was available, but it was cordoned off to these specific locations. And so using laws and norms, you could more or less say, okay, we're going to make this available only to certain people, or there has to be this specific catalog, but we're going to still be able to enforce this norm of saying hardcore pornography is not a central part of the culture. Then you move to the internet and there's no mechanism to police it. And there's no, if you have a complete flattening that if you go to a weather site and you go to a hardcore pornography site, there's really no difference between putting those URLs in. So it's impossible to then enforce hardcore pornography in this kind of non-policed system. So then when you get to things later, like Paris Hilton, so Paris Hilton, let's say she gets out of a car not wearing underwear and paparazzi have these photos. Obviously, you can't put that on TV and you can't put that on, you can talk about it on TV, but you can't show the photos. And the internet was always there to show the photos. And so one of the boosts for the internet was that it was a way to get around the norms that you had in mass media. Is that you can't do this. You can't slander people as easily. You can't have, you know, print rumors. You can't do all these things in mass media, but you can do it online because it's just not policed. And so the fact that the internet is always an out, that it always allows groups who are, you know, the social norms are pushing and marginalizing out to have their own voice and have their own communities and have their own economies, it's made it almost impossible within the mainstream culture to enforce those norms. And so if you have a Kanye West who makes horrific anti-Semitic statements and gets canceled from mass media, you go online and hip hop sites are still talking about his, you know, when is his new album going to drop? And you get, you know, ways for him to monetize what he's doing with his fans directly. And his tracks still go on to the streaming services. And they're some of the most popular of the year. So it's impossible really to actually enforce the norm of you cannot be an anti-Semitic pop star. You can't go out and make horrific statements. And then also, you know, you're going to be driven from mass society, but you can't be driven from the internet. And so I think that's another factor of the internet that I think has been overlooked, is just the degree to which it has made norms more or less useless. And because of the attention structure of the internet, the more you break social norms, the more attention you get. And the way that the media works in terms of needing clicks, then writing about norm breaking is the way that you get more clicks on your site. And so norm breaking itself becomes a more virtuous activity than norm basically sticking to norms, and therefore norms themselves become meaningless in our society.
Well, let's talk about this, because this is one of the big ideas of your book, is that this collapse of norm upholding, this norm evasion, it leads kind of inexorably to the rise of Vice, Gavin McInnes and the Proud Boys, that sort of thing. Walk us through this, because I find this really interesting. I think it's something that we have to understand, and it kind of dovetails with my basic theory of the internet, which is that once upon a time, there were lots of weirdos and they were all separate and they had mimeograph machines. Mm-hmm. Now all of the weirdos are on the internet and they realize that there's a lot of them, not compared to the rest of the world, maybe, but there's still enough to have influence. And that has been the truly disastrous part of the internet.
So, I mean, look, let's start with Vice, because in no way do I think what he was doing was that unique, in the sense of there's always been kind of a transgressive and right-wing ideas have come together before. But what Gavin McInnes did very specifically in the early 2000s was that it was a backlash against normie liberalism kind of winning out in the 90s. And so in order to have a transgressive kind of punk rock attitude, you had to fight against the man, and the man became political correctness and Clintonian liberalism and Lilith Fair feminism. And so the magazine found its transgressive power in saying racial epithets and writing about doing drugs in a non-transcendent way, but just to kind of, you know, to deaden yourself, very kind of predatory sexuality. So all these things that were just positioned against 90s liberalism, that was inevitable in the sense somebody was going to get there, but Gavin McInnes got there first. I don't think that necessarily he influenced 4chan or what became kind of alt-right. I mean, it's interesting that he showed back up in the alt-right. It's just that he got to the formula before anyone else did. And he did it in a time in which I think New York wouldn't have considered itself conservative at all. But I was there during 9/11 and those next couple of years. And it's not necessarily that, you know, Gavin would do something in Vice that felt very right-wing to me, that felt very kind of playing footsie with Nazis. And the people around me wouldn't necessarily be like, well, that's too far. Like, it was kind of just seen as a big ironic joke that he was, you know, pushing people's buttons. And then so when he showed up forming the Proud Boys and having that be part of the alt-right, especially with the election of Trump in 2016, that to me felt like a natural bridge, where it's like, well, of course, that's kind of where he ended up. And if you go back and read John Gans's When the Clock Broke about the 90s and talking about Pat Buchanan and David Duke and all this, I mean, these are central figures in Gavin McInnes's world. I mean, there's an anecdote about him pulling out a Pat Buchanan book to read to the Proud Boys. And the reason that the stated for him leaving Vice is that he was bragging about hanging around with David Duke, right? So Gavin is kind of in the middle of pop culture, and he is a bridge between that 90s conservatism that lost and then the conservatism that won in 2016. But really, he's just a vector, or just kind of a symptom of a larger thing, which is that the transgressiveness of pop culture, which was what powered so much pop culture in the 20th century, and especially consumerism, you know, using revolution in a Nike ad, or just the Think Different campaign that Apple did, but just the sense of cultural transgression is a social good, and it is what kind of, you know, is exciting and what makes consumer products valuable. To twist that and make it a conservative transgressiveness, and for that to have been so effective in a political sphere as well. So I think Gavin is one of the first people to come to that conclusion, and it started, you know, in 2001 and moved forward, and it kind of went up and down. But I see it when we talk about this 25-year period, and I was writing the book, you know, not knowing who was going to win the 2024 election. So it could have been that I got to the end, it was like, well, Trump was just a blip. And obviously that's not the way things are anymore. But it really did seem, mm-hmm. based off of Trump winning in 2024, that, okay, this everything from 2001 here is a straight line, in a sense that this idea of transgressive conservatism was a very powerful idea, in that it mixed one of the most popular seductive and alluring parts of pop culture, and it took that to imbue conservatism with a new spirit that really attracted young people and gave it a new lease on life compared to what Newt Gingrich was trying to do in the 90s, which is just roll back the entire counterculture.
Yeah, you describe it in your book as the counterculture, and that is, I think, a good way. I mean, it is reactionary in a very real and like just very fundamental way. Just they're reacting against the dominance of the kind of fairly straightforward center left ideas of diversity and inclusion and all that stuff. And what was interesting, what's interesting in the book is reading you say, look, these conservatives, they describe themselves as the new punks, and they were, because that is a way that I have heard people on the right describe themselves for years and always been kind of dismissed as, right, sure. But it does feel like there is a genuine countercultural energy to it that is hard to figure out how to push back on without looking like a stiff in a square.
Yep. I mean, look, in the 20th century, if you go back and look at the Teddy Boys, which were one of the first subcultures, they were fiercely anti-immigrant. I would say generally had a lot of kind of provincial right-wing ideas. And then you get to the skinheads, who maybe started not as a neo-Nazi group, but blended in by the 70s with the neo-Nazi movement in the UK. So there's always been a side of subculture that has been the kind of found conservative ideas. I mean, and you probably can go back to obviously fascism and futurism in the 1910s in Italy as well. So these things have existed before, but it really... The number of people, and I would say that who are not subcultural, like just normal people who felt like they're being oppressed by progressive ideals and needed to push back against it and felt some kind of power in pushing back against that, is the story of the last, 10 to 15 years. And what's interesting about it is the degree to which, obviously turn it into kind of a political success, but that it kind of shows the degree to which liberalism won out, in that these basic ideals of inclusion and pluralistic society have become embedded so much in consumer society and pop culture that if you do not believe in pluralism and you wake up every day, you do feel like you are being oppressed by these forces. And to the fact that so many people have felt this way, and they're justifying becoming right wing based off of this feeling, this kind of cultural feeling, I think is quite interesting. And in some ways it can be nihilistic and not have anything to do with the policies whatsoever. It's just kind of a mood, but that there's no question that was happening. And then you got to the end of 2024 and there's all these think pieces, like it's really uncool to be liberal, that resistance is cringe. I mean, I think one of the big problems with resistance at the beginning of this year was that it just didn't have a cultural moment the way that it did in 2017. And if you compare No Kings to the Women's March, had a soundtrack with Beyonce and had the Pussy Hat and had all these pop cultural moments, and No Kings is kind of devoid of any pop culture at all. I mean, I think that's why it's successful, is because it's really for trying to show it's for everybody. It's not one taste culture over another. But the degree to which there has been a retreat from pure progressive liberalism as a pop culture, the engine of pop culture, is like a massive change, I think, in the last 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you highlight is that there was a stretch again around this time, the 2015 to 2020 or so, where you're talking about the ways in which culture refreshes itself, ways in which culture renews itself, and we're talking about cancel culture here, right? And so the the sentence is very good. The mechanism had simply been different for renewing the culture. Cancellation by taste. And this is, we now were in a period where artists were getting pushed out based on politics. But I do kind of wonder, I mean, I look at this and I do sense the reaction that caused. I mean, there was an absolute downside to that, which is that it did push a lot of people into the far right, I think. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being oversensitive here.
I mean, if you look at the main... My take on this time is, if you look at a Bill Cosby or R. Kelly, I mean, these are criminal monsters that I don't think there's really any argument that they've been canceled as much as just there's legal ramifications for the crimes they committed. And so there's that. Sure, I mean, then sure. There's the question of, are these, I mean, take a Kanye or a Louis C.K. So maybe those are more marginal. In the case of Louis C.K., he won a Grammy after, you know, being so-called canceled. He has a whole online fan community he can monetize. Again, Kanye's running around the world doing big concerts, still working on music. So I don't know. I mean, I think that, I don't want to dig too much into the whole cancel culture debate, because it's obviously very contentious. Yeah. But it just used to be that there was, when New Kids on the Block disappeared in the early 1990s, it was not because they committed some sort of, crime, or that they had a political position that people didn't like. It was simply that New Kids on the Block were incredibly lame, and that when Nirvana came out, that kind of manufactured pop became anathema to everybody, and they just completely disappeared. And that mechanism is more or less gone now. And so if we're going to have any people disappearing from the culture, it really seems that politics or personal behavior is the only way to remove people. I'm saying that in a neutral way. I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but the main point is just that in an omnivore culture, you can't really tell people to go away because they don't make the right kind of thing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get back to the technology question, because I find it really interesting and really inseparable from everything we're discussing here. Because the story of music sales over the last 30 years or so, right, as CDs and tapes to CD, whatever, vinyl to tapes to CDs. And then the internet comes along, and you've got Napster, which obviously changes things pretty radically. iPods, iPhones, streaming ends up giving everything to everybody for nothing, essentially, for the equivalent of nothing compared to what people used to pay for music. You see something similar in movies, right? Movies, you know, you had theatrical, for a long time you had movies in theaters, and then they'd show on TV for a bit, and there was money made there. And then DVDs come in, and there's this huge influx of cash, and then streaming comes along and wipes out everything, and changes how all of that money gets made and distributed. And then you have TV, which goes from the kind of weekly release model to the binge model, and now is kind of edging back towards the weekly release model, as I think most of the companies realize they can't afford to put out the 10 hours of television every week, entire series every week. That does not work. How has the form of technology changed how people consume media and art? And B, how has it affected the way that is appreciated? Because I feel like this is a very long question with too many parts, but I feel like we look at like TV, for instance. You had this period of TV where there were these weekly shows that were coming out, The Sopranos, all the way up through, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, whatever, where there were weekly shows coming out and people would do recaps on the websites and there would be lots of discussion. And now everything just kind of comes out and it sits there and maybe gets discussed for a day and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that's not conducive to a real cultural refreshing. I feel like all of this stuff is just there all the time, and that's bad.
Yeah. I mean, look, one of the criticisms of the book is that TV has gotten a lot better, and I don't really give it credit. And I agree with that. I mean, if you go back and look at just a normal 90s TV show and compare it to The Wire or The Rehearsal or The Chair Company or something, I mean, the things have gotten a lot better, and there's a lot of great television. There's so many ways that technology has changed the experience from micro to macro. I mean, if you think about, I used to find 24 really funny because they would have a cliffhanger at every commercial break, but they just became more and more frivolous where they would have a cliffhanger and then they come back from the commercial and solve it within 5 seconds and then move on to whatever the plot was. And so there's parts of the structure that actually changed the content, right? And so the cliffhanger is like a very good example of that. Then there's also the fact that, as you said, by dumping everything in one day and doing binging, great, you can win a week or so, but it kind of falls from our memory instantly. And so I think a show like Succession really succeeded in being a cultural moment because it was doing one episode a week. And so every Sunday or whenever it was, people were coming together to watch it and talk about it. And the jokes would kind of, and the memes would continue for a week and then kind of go back to the next episode. The thing that I do worry about is that if you have a show like The Rehearsal, which I find brilliant, and the second season in particular was so interesting and so innovative for the format of reality TV and even comedy itself, you know, for that brief period that it was on, people were talking about it quite a bit. And then, you know, no one ever talked about it again. And then you'll say, like, you know, it was a great show, The Rehearsal, and people are like, oh yeah, that was great. But, you know, it's kind of faded from memory. And that seems different than something like Twin Peaks in the 90s, which is that I think things were so bad. The television was so mediocre that you had this one very strange, brilliant show that people became cult-like fans about, and they talked about it and thought about it forever. And it really informed culture. Or Simpsons, the fact that, you know, everything that happens in the world, you can find a Simpsons joke that somehow, you know, matches it. So I think there is something about streaming and the freeness or the relative low cost that has made us devalue things. But we also get into this expectation cycle that we know something else is going to come again. And so anything that we had, we enjoy for that brief moment, but we don't feel that scarcity of we got to go back to it in a way that I know in the 90s, I recorded, you know, every Simpsons on a VHS and we went and rewatched it because every day I didn't know, turning on the TV, that there's going to be something that could hold my attention. And now we're just in this pattern of, okay, there was a great album that came out this week, but in 2 weeks, I'm sure there's going to be another great album again. So we don't need to hoard. We can just kind of surf on the streaming wave given to us. And so I think that just creates a massive devaluation of culture itself. And now AI is going to, you know, then talking about technology, AI is going to devalue all media. Yeah. Because anything can be created with a prompt, and everything that you see is untrustworthy. There's something going to be, I wrote an essay last year about thinking about AI as polyester. The polyester was also an incredibly useful fabric, and it started showing up in everything. And then there was a backlash against polyester, that polyester was a marker of low class. And, you know, Ralph Lauren did a whole campaign about guaranteed to wrinkle about its linen. And so the properties that were great about polyester became its worst parts. And so the actual aesthetic of polyester became tainted over time. And I think you're going to see that with AI as well, just that it's going to look worse and worse the better and better it gets. And then we're going to just devalue all media, perhaps. I mean, all music, all film, all movies, unless we can really get a sense that it's created by an actual person.
This kind of dovetails into my last point here, which is the importance of curation and the importance of gatekeepers. I know gatekeepers have it's an ugly word. People don't like the word gatekeepers. But it does feel like we have lost. At the very least, it makes it easier to consume things when there is somebody who tells you, okay, this is what is worth listening to. This is what isn't. I'll just use myself as an example here, because I, for a long time, just didn't listen to very much new music. I have kids, and I'm listening to things I liked when I was 20s. And I finally started listening to XMU, the new, like, their indie rock station. And it's been great. It's been great because I have somebody who is like, okay, here are the things to listen to. And whether or not XMU is, you know, the be all end all, whatever, it was a guide. It was a guidepost. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what we have lost. If what we have lost outweighs what we have gained. But also B, just wonder what do the new gatekeepers look like? Is it possible to even have gatekeepers and curators in a real way anymore?
I mean, I certainly think we can do it and people are hungry for it. I think what's the way to think about this, the word gatekeeping is changed, right? It used to mean kind of the horrible gallery owners and critics who are making sure that no new blood goes into the system, or really, really strict about the kind of new artists that move into the system. Now we're using the term gatekeeping to mean, I know about this thing, but I'm not going to tell you about it. People mean it for, I don't want to spread this on the internet because then everyone finds out about it and it gets ruined, which is kind of an interesting thing. But the word gatekeeping and people talking about snobbery being good, and I think these are all slightly the wrong solution to the problem. The main thing is to think about what are we solving for? And it used to be that if you went to your older brother or your friend's older brother or something, and I don't mean to gender it so much, but that's at least how it was in the 90s, then you would say, like, I'm really into Teenage Fan Club. Do you have the Teenage Fan Club CD? And they'd be like, oh, well, if you're into that, you should listen to Dinosaur Jr. Here's some more challenging music that you maybe have not heard of. Go listen to this. And the same thing, if you go to a professor and say, I'm interested in this topic, they would point you to more deep things that you would not know rather than here's the more shallow things. What an algorithm is solving for is trying to make the best guess about here's the thing that will keep you on the platform longest. And so, oh, if you like this video about the history of dog breeds, here's some dogs running around in the snow. Aren't they cute? Because other people who are interested in dogs, here's the thing that they watched. And so the algorithms just doesn't care if you become a smarter person with better taste or isn't really trying to challenge you. It's trying to do the opposite. And so rather than thinking about gatekeeping, because gatekeeping can certainly be bad because most of the great revolutionary inventive culture of our times is things that gatekeepers and, you know, at first did not like. And so you don't want to also create a system in which you have these gatekeepers block things. It's simply just to have everybody in the system, or at least enough people in the system, trying to solve for pushing the medium forward or getting people to have better tastes. And the thing I thought about a lot recently is when you got the recommendation from an older sibling about you should listen to this, it wasn't necessarily just that it was introduction. It was also this sort of pressure that you would listen to it and then you would listen to it until you understood it. And so I remember getting Pixies' album Doolittle because I liked one of the songs on it, but then listening to it and be like, I don't know what's going on. This is a little frightening. Like it actually, you know, was quite alienating for me, but the sense of like, this is a cool album that I should understand. I should just keep listening to it over and over again until you like it. And I think there was more of that where you were faced with something that felt challenging and you would push through. And some of the pushing through was not altruistic or like a diet. Like I know that it's not fun to diet, but I'm going to do it anyway. It was just a sense of like, I'm not going to be cool unless I understand this thing. And so I think the liberation that we felt saying there's no more guilty pleasures and there's no high art, there's no low art, and everything's equal was a sense that we didn't have to challenge ourselves anymore to try to enjoy culture that is at first difficult. But everybody knows that when you push yourself to understand something more difficult, not only do you expand your pleasure of that thing, you expand your pleasure of multiple things because you just become a person who can appreciate more things and has a deeper appreciation of culture in general. And so the part about gatekeeping, I think, that's lost is, yes, the introduction of having people who know more than you tell you, go check out these things. But then also having the pressure to try to keep up with those people and to push yourself to have better taste and be more adventurous and all of those things. And so I think that is solved again by values. This system is not going to solve that for us. We're not going to wake up one day and the internet decides that it's more lucrative for the platforms to push us to challenging things rather than easy things. It's always going to push us to easy things. So we have to just make a value judgment on our own, that's the way we think about criticism. We think about our own consumption, that we, you know, pressure our friends to give culture they don't understand the first time more chances, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the way that the culture used to be. Indie and alternative culture was not market driven. It was value driven.
Yeah. Well, that was everything I wanted to ask you. We covered so much, and we barely have scratched the surface here. I mean, we haven't even gotten into meme culture and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You really have to check out the book again. It's Blank Space: A Cultural History of the 21st Century by David Marks. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If you think there's anything folks should know about the book or the state of things, what did we not discuss that we should have?
I mean, the book, when it comes out, you know, reviews really focus on what's the thesis and is the thesis right or wrong. And the book it does have a strong thesis that we've talked about, but it's also just a linear chronological history of the things that happened. And I think you can go back and look at that history and say, okay, I think you've over-indexed some of the worst aspects, the Paris Hiltons and the dumb YouTube viral videos or whatever it is. On the same token, would it be possible to write a book about these years that didn't mention these things and or reconstructed a history of all the great art that's been created in these 25 years? I think that would be somewhat more of a stretch. And so I think I actually have this anxiety about it, which is that was I too harsh on these 25 years? And I think one of the most important things is that there was certainly good culture and good art created in these 25 years. The question is, was that art and were those inventive fashions and plays or whatever, are they representative of these 25 years more than Kim Kardashian was, more than Donald Trump or Kanye West? To me, Paris Hilton, Kim Kardashian, Kanye West, Donald Trump, these do seem to be the dominating figures of our era. And there were much more talented people, much more virtuous people in this period. But I think the question to ask is why they were pushed to the side and really didn't rise to the fore in the way that I think if we go back and look at the 20th century, there's more people we can feel heroic about. And maybe, you know, I'm a big fan of the Beatles. I've read enough Beatles books to know that they weren't the greatest humans during that period. But I think there's a lot of virtue in the art itself to look back on. And that's why people love the Beatles so much. So it's not just a question of, you know, the artists themselves being virtuous or not. It's the actual art that is the best has just not risen to the top. And I think that's the crisis I'm talking about, not a crisis of nobody is creating great art out there. It's just a question of why is the system not raising that up to the idea that you would write a book being like, this was an incredible 25 years where everybody has more access to cultural production tools than ever before, can distribute to everyone around the world, can get feedback from everybody. I mean, on paper, this 25 years should have been a time of cultural explosion, and yet that's not the way we feel about it. And so that's the tension I'm trying to think through. But, you know, I don't think this is the last history of the period that's going to be written, and I'd be really interested in alternative takes about what this 25 years was. And I do think that as time moves forward, we're going to find different parts of these 25 years that seem trivial now, but actually become much more important. And so it's, I wanted to get down in 2025, how somebody in 2025 felt about that 25 year period. I'm interested in see how the story shifts in the next 10 years.
I mean, everything is changing all the time. So I don't know, maybe things will get better here. Fingers crossed. I don't know. David, thank you again for being on the show. The name of the book, Blank Space: A Cultural History of the 21st Century. Check it out. I strongly recommend it. It's a very quick read. And again, if you have lived through this period, you will recognize much of it, for better or worse. David, thanks for being on.
Thanks so much.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.